This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'll do the intro and just like introduce you.
Okay.
But don't help me out. If I start bombing.
Is there a new song?
If I start bombing, don't.
Oh, no, I'll hang you out to dry.
Yeah, please do. Lots of idle fingers snapped. Welcome to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goys. I'm Kevin. We're slowing it down. We're getting a little intimate. We're dimming the lights. We're lighting a candle. We're lighting, seven candles. Hanukkah. That's a thing. Seven? Might be seven. Might be eight. Don't know. No help in the room. But anyway, we wanted to take a look back on the season as a whole. The eight episodes that we watched. The eight episodes that you listened to. And say, just, what was that? What happened there? What was going on? I just want to take this moment and say thank you for listening to the show thus far. It's been a blast. It's been a pleasure.
Wait, just for the 30 seconds you've been talking?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just for the 30 seconds so far.
Do you get a lot of people like bailing in the first minute of the show?
Oh, yeah.
So you want to thank the people that have stuck with it.
Oh, yeah. No,
smart.
My favorites are the people who send in corrections before we say the right thing by the end of the show. And then they follow up with like, oh, I just finished. Forgive me. So that's a thing. But guys, let's do it. Let's introduce him once and for all. Folks, you may know him from Baby Mama or Dirty Grandpa.
Some of the greats.
Probably his two best credits. Or you can see him now on The Good Place and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Jason Mantzoukas!
Big reaction in the room.
Baby.
Big reaction in the room.
Sir.
How are we doing?
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back. I'm sorry that I missed you in the episode.
In the episode. No worries, sir. No worries. We stretched it out as long as we could, but here we are now.
I understand. And here we are, thrilled to be here to talk about my favorite show of the year.
Is it your favorite of 2017?
It was my favorite of the new shows.
Wow.
I feel like I'm trying to think what I enjoyed more last year.
Okay.
And very little is the answer.
Okay.
I mean, very little did I enjoy as much or more than this. I loved this show. Also, eight candles.
Well, that's a tweet we will not get
exactly.
Now because
people
of
are
that,
like, oh, thank God.
That correction.
But now I'm second guessing myself. Also, not Jewish.
We're not going to look it up. I know this is Maisel Goys. This is non-Jewish people.
Yep.
Talking about a lot of Jewish stuff.
Yeah, smart. And I'm assuming you stuck to it and had no Jews as guests.
We did not allow them on.
Yep.
We said, sorry, this one's for us.
Well, and this is on that alt-right podcast network.
Yeah. I mean, the InfoWars podcast network is going to be taking off pretty soon. This is their flagship show.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Did they try and lure you away?
They did, yeah, from HeadGum. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, there was a very competitive
bidding
war.
We love what you guys are up to.
Oh, boy. NRA TV. That's something launching pretty quick. We could get on the ground floor if we wanted to.
You know, I'm already pitching.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've got some good pitches for them.
Nice, dude. Nice. What's
Thank
the first
you.
Pitch?
You know what? I'm not at liberty to say.
Okay, sure. No, I don't want
to
violate the NDAs of the NRAs. I don't want to violate.
But I've got some pretty big stars looking to get in on it.
So, Jason, why was this your favorite show of the year? What about
it
more so than any of the ASP stuff or any of the other new stuff that came out last year?
As you may or may not know,
sure.
I am an absolute diehard, ride-or-die Amy Sherman-Palladino fan.
Yeah.
Everything.
Jezebel James on.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's where I jumped on. I was like, wait, Parker Posey and Lauren Ambrose?
Yeah.
I'm in. And it's a half hour?
You're like
multicam?
You're like the Beatles fan that started with John and Yoko screaming records.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. For me, it really is like maybe because I was really looking forward to it, maybe because I read this pilot when it first was like circulating and I was excited.
Sure.
I read this pilot and was like, this is great. Because I feel like for me, Gilmore Girls, untouchable, except for certain later seasons. Bunheads.
Touchable. You could touch Bunheads.
You could touch it. Well, hang on.
You shouldn't.
Kevin,
I'm saying
those are,
you shouldn't.
Those are young girls.
But you could.
Those are young girls. The only person I'm touching in Bunheads is Sutton Foster. Or Kelly Bishop. Or the Queen.
Yeah.
The Queen Kelly Bishop.
Happy 74th, Kelly Bishop.
Is it today is her birthday?
No, it was like a week ago.
Oh, well,
but
then,
in case she listens to this 2 weeks later.
Yeah. Well, oh, yeah. She texted me earlier. She's very backed up on podcasts.
Right. Yeah. She's got a lot of StoryCorps to go
she's
through.
She's got so much StoryCorps to go through. So many tearful revelations of family stories and secrets.
Yeah. Liberal Epiphany. That's right.
Exactly. Is that the name for it? Liberal Epiphany?
I feel like that's the subtitle of every NPR podcast.
Absolutely.
In some sense. Where it's like, and then I realized, and maybe we're not so different.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even though we are white and privileged,
we are not so different. If you haven't listened to it, I will say A Very Fatal Murder.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It actually has like a POV and something to say. If you've heard
of
that, it's
a podcast
parody show.
Yeah. That's what I'm assuming.
Onion News Network. But they kind of eviscerate the right sort of targets.
Okay.
In the right
good.
Way,
great.
I would say.
I'll listen to it.
You are someone who I think consumes what I would call an insane amount of media on a regular basis. Or what would appear to be. You do, we talked about this last time, you keep a Soderbergh-esque diary.
I do, although
everything.
I have just fallen off of it the last, like, month.
Oh, wow.
Which I need to get back on.
In preparation for this podcast.
Yes, yes. No, I do. I keep a list of everything I read, watch, or listen to.
Sure.
I mean, listen to meaning like a podcast or a, you know,
an album.
An audiobook.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
I wouldn't do an album.
You wouldn't do an album?
No, I wouldn't list like just listening to an afternoon of music.
Okay.
I wouldn't do that. But if I listen to something that is, that's interesting. I wonder what the, why I don't know why I make that. Well, probably because, I don't know why I make that difference, but I don't list, music or just kind of anecdotally listening to the radio or whatever.
Sure.
But if I listen to...
If you tried to track radio stuff, you'd go
right,
insane.
But even if I listened, it's, yeah, but if I listen to like an episode of whatever, Cocaine and Rhinestones, I will put that down. You know, I don't know what the difference is. I think maybe, I don't know. Anyway, so I do consume quite a bit of stuff.
So what's your metric for whether you're going to opt into something or not? Especially TV shows, is it like, I'll give it one episode, I'll give it two episodes?
It depends on what it is.
Okay.
It depends on what it is. It really depends on if I feel like it is, its first episode or two are demonstrative of what it is. Because sometimes people will be like, give it three episodes. Mm-hmm. Like The Wire, you have to get to the third episode or whatever, you know, people will tell you but if it's something that I feel like, oh, this is what it is, like, then I'll be like, okay, I think this is not mine, I don't think I need to watch the rest of this.
Which I feel like that rule was much easier to do even like 5 years ago when there was like
250% less shows.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
Now it's like if I'm not into it by the end of one, I feel like I'm going to walk away from it.
And I also will walk away from things like midway through.
Yeah.
You know, like I watched 3 episodes of Ozark.
Uh-huh.
And it's not that I didn't enjoy it. I just.
For Chris Ryan?
Yes. simply to please Chris Ryan. Happy birthday, Chris Ryan.
Happy birthday, Chris Ryan.
But I was like, I'm enjoying this, but there is enough that I'm enjoying more that I don't feel compelled to follow through to the end. Maybe at some point I will be like home on a Sunday and I'll for some reason decide to finish Ozark. And that's kind of the beauty of it. It is still there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a book that I left with the page turned down, you know?
Would you ever walk out of a movie if you weren't feeling it?
Almost never.
Almost never.
It would take a lot for me to walk out of a movie.
Is there an exception that you can remember?
I don't think I've ever walked out of... I don't think I've ever walked out of a movie with the exception of... I believe my entire family walked out of the Lou Ferrigno Hercules movie.
Okay.
When I was a kid.
Sure.
And I only know this because I think this is a story like my family then told about like how bad this movie was.
Right.
I remember it because at a certain point, Lou Ferrigno as Hercules picks up a bear. He's fighting a bear. He throws the bear into outer space. And the bear becomes the constellation Ursa Major.
Okay, so it's for the ridiculousness.
It was just terrible.
It wasn't a political statement.
Also, you heard me say Lou Ferrigno, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Anyway,
So with Maisel, you already bought in because...
Oh, I was on board.
Because of Paladino, and you had read the script.
On board. And I really was like, ooh, what excited me about it, because I felt like Gilmore Girls was like such a great, wonderful distillation of what makes Amy Sherman-Palladino like one of the true, like, original writers, mm-hmm. original voices of her generation. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I've said it before on this podcast, I think of Amy Sherman-Palladino the same way. Like, it to me... is a crime, the book about showrunners, the book that was like Milch, Sorkin, Matt Weiner,
was that
David
Difficult
Chase,
Men?
Difficult Men,
yeah.
Was called, like, it makes me crazy that Amy Sherman-Palladino was not in that book, because mm-hmm. I think she is just as original a voice and from that same era as those men, and it makes me crazy. So I'm all in on Amy Sherman-Palladino, but... for me, Bunheads and then Gilmore Girls, Winter, Spring, Summer, Fall,
yeah.
were not as strong as OG Gilmore Girls.
Do you feel like you had a lot to do with
I felt like
Gilmore
I
Girls
raised the stakes. I feel like I raised the stakes. I will say, like, the episode with me and it was
flawless.
Made worse because of me.
No, that's not true.
No. It was, and there was stuff that I loved about that season of television,
yeah.
but it was uneven. I think we can all agree.
Uneven is charitable. Yeah, that's
yeah.
fair. That's fair.
And when I read that pilot for Mrs. Maisel, I was like, this is great. Because I felt like very smartly, it kind of eschewed the stuff that was to me problematic by being set in the 50s, right?
Yeah, 1958.
By being a period piece, we kind of got rid of a lot of the noise of, like, pop culture references, of, like, stuff that to me was starting to feel, like, not true or not real.
Sure.
And so, like, I read that script and I was like, ooh, I love this. This feels very real and very organic to her voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then I loved the character. I loved the main character, I thought, was just amazing. And so then when I watched it, I got even more excited because I thought Rachel Brosnahan was amazing. I had no idea who that was and was blown away. And also, I thought it was executed, like, wonderfully.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it looked great. So I was very into it. And then the whole series came out, crushed it in a weekend. Loved every goddamn
weekend,
minute of it.
Stayed in.
Also, it had boobs in it. So I like, Amy, here's an equation I can get behind.
An intersection
Amy Sherman
of your
Palladino,
interests.
Stand-up comedy, and boobs? Yes.
Oh, boy. Well, no, and I was going to ask the context in which you did watch it, because I feel like that does make a difference. There's certain shows I've only seen on planes. Like, I only watched Transparent on a plane, which,
really?
By the way... not a great show to watch on a plane.
No, that's like... that
everyone
be,
thinks you're a weirdo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
no.
there'd be a lot of crying, I
yeah,
feel
yeah.
like. Very, I don't try not to watch anything emotional on a plane, because when I'm on a plane, I get so emotional.
Yeah.
So then I end up like weeping
you're
at Sisterhood
emotional.
Of the Traveling Pants 2.
Did that happen?
True story.
Ha ha.
Openly weeping at Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 2. Openly weeping at Boss Baby.
The why, Boss Baby?
Why am I, like, when the like the boy discovers, like, it's great to have a brother, I was like, oh, no.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So you're already emotional by the time you're in the air.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I shouldn't watch Paddington 2 on a plane.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Like, I think you should only watch horror movies. Like, I'm not sure what it is. Or just
or
get,
comedies
okay.
or, yeah, yeah.
Or I just am like, okay, I guess I'm going to just be the guy who is just, like, weeping at whatever cheesy movie I've
decided
to
watch. Do people try
to
console you? Do they notice you?
No. I would hope people
you
don't
suck
try and,
in
please
the
don't,
weeping.
Don't okay. try and console me. If you're hearing this and you see me on a plane, don't
try
and console me.
If you see Jason on a plane, don't console him. It's okay. Just let people act out their grief.
Yeah, just like let me have my moment.
You watch the whole thing at home.
I watch the whole thing at home.
Yeah.
I think I watched the whole thing in a weekend, or maybe if not that much time, like not much more. And I loved it. I thought it was really exceptional first season of television.
Mm-hmm.
It was so well done and such a, to me, such a fantastic evolution of what Amy and Dan, I guess, do.
I guess.
From, you know, I'll include Dan.
Yeah. Throw him in.
Taking what they do and really converting it. Like, it's every single element jumped mm-hmm. up a notch to me.
Totally.
You know, it,
from production design
yes,
to cinematography.
Everything.
To,
like yeah. it is shot beautifully, mm-hmm. which you can't really often say for a lot of the other, for Gilmore Girls or some of the Bunheads dance sequences I thought were great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was exceptional filmmaking, I thought. And then the cast is fucking deep. That bench I thought was great. Everybody steps up and delivers, with a few exceptions. I was, you know, I think I texted you. I was texting anybody and everybody to be
get
on board for this.
That's an interesting thing that happens sometimes. Like, I don't know what your rule is for when you get into a show or a movie, because oftentimes what people do, people who are on social media, they'll like, you know, post about and say, guys, you got to check out blah, blah, blah. You got to see this. So for you who doesn't like, you know, go in those waters.
Sure.
What's your kind of philosophy for sharing that with people or talking to people about it?
Because I don't have social media, I am limited to texting friends, which I will do if I think people will like it.
Yeah.
Or I do have the outlet of I will just shamelessly promote things I like via my podcast. How did this get made?
Yeah.
Or I will legitimately improvise my fandom of certain things into character monologues in TV shows or movies that I'm in.
Did that happen recently?
Oh, yeah. There's been a bunch of things. Like, there are a number of characters I've played in things that have an unhealthy amount of knowledge for Gilmore Girls, Magnum P.I., or Harry Potter.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. One thing that we did format-wise on this show that was, like, a titch bit different than other shows and episodes we've done is at the end of the episode.
There was no singing? No singing?
That's one thing I was thinking about coming into it. I was like, okay, I can't sing. I'm not going to do it, especially if it's just me.
You can sing.
I could.
I will just relentlessly come at you.
No, I understand, and I deserve it. Although, this does feel... Doesn't Marvelous Mrs. Maisel feel like a musical in so many ways? Even in that finale where
could have tipped into singing, being a musical at times.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it would not feel weird.
And oftentimes those times they did choose, I feel like, appropriate songs to soundtrack those moments with, in like almost instead of having them burst into song, they would just do a musical number just to a track.
Here's some Streisand.
Yeah, exactly. That's
Cole
a good
Porter
one.
Or whatever. Yeah.
But, yeah. And boy, the music in this show is, they must have spent $5 million just for music.
Get two Babs tracks?
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Every time I was like, they are going for it with these musical numbers. This is great. This must have been so expensive.
And
it's a license.
To me, out of the recent crop of TV shows, it's one of the better soundtracks just because...
Honestly, how many hats did Amy Sherman-Palladino have to sell in order to buy these tracks?
Oh, at least 2, 3, 5 dozen.
Yeah.
But I do like to think that all the royalty money they had to pay to the Streisand estate, or just Streisand because she's still alive, went to directly to the dog clones.
I'm sure.
So that's one thing, because you're kind of a music geek.
Sure.
Right? In some ways, you study music in
very
school.
Very much.
You were into it. Are there any tracks in particular that stood out to you, or any musical
moments from the show?
The
Streisand ones were great. I'm trying to remember. I watched it now a while ago, so I'm trying to remember. I remember the Streisand, the first time Streisand started being like, whoa.
Yeah.
How much was this? Just really being like, how much did they pay for this song?
Which is so funny, again, as an intersection of your interest, because you're not a musical guy.
Like, no, I hate musicals.
You legit hate them.
I hate
You like some
musicals.
Of them. You've seen some and you're like, they're fine.
I've seen some and they're fine.
Yeah.
No, that's not true. I've seen some and they're not fine.
Saw Hamilton and it was fine.
With the possible exception of Hamilton, which I thought was great.
Yeah.
You know, which I thought was great. And I will say this, I don't mind, and you maybe you'll know because I'm forgetting right now, Hamilton, part of what works for Hamilton for me is the same as what works with The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. It is all sung. The whole show is sung. So what is egregious to me about a musical is that you're interrupting a play I'm enjoying to sing a dumb song.
Yeah.
And I'd rather you just keep showing me the play versus something that is entirely sung is still the show. It's like a consistency that I can get on board for.
Right.
So Hamilton works for me. Umbrellas of Cherbourg work for me. But like, you know, the producers... When they did The Producers on Broadway, I was like, no, I don't want these songs. I'm not interested in singing. And by the way, I've seen this movie. There aren't songs in it.
Right.
Like this. This is crazy. Get them out of here.
You are going to hate The Greatest Showman
when
we go see it right after we're done recording.
Wait, is
today.
That what we're doing?
Yeah.
Have we planned a whole day together?
Look under your seat. There's two.
Oh, God.
I thought it'd be nice to spend some quality time for once. For once, come in here.
Is that why Alice isn't here?
I mean, I said she was sick. Alice isn't sick. Alice is dead. No, she's tied up in the other room. It's fine.
I believe it.
No. So
you, some sort of deranged boy-like serial killer, Kevin? What? Impossible.
Come on. No, I would not do that. That's going to be the last podcast I ever do.
Demented Archie serial killer running around
Archie.
Riverdale.
Now, here's the thing. Everyone's done their version of a true crime podcast.
Sure.
But no one's ever hosted it where they're the culprit.
Wow.
So I'm thinking...
From the inside.
Exactly. And this is my pitch to InfoWars.
Wait, is this the pilot?
Yeah, this is the pilot. It's like, who killed him? Oh, you know from
the
beginning.
That's the parody podcast. It's like a serial killers podcast.
Yeah.
That is live, and the podcast lasts as long as the person has to live, and you're giving clues for how to save the person, and people listening can either save or not.
Oh, yeah. It's a real snowman situation.
But that way
you get engagement, you get social media.
Oh, you get them likes?
Yeah. Oh, you get them retweets.
Oh, people are
going to
get very involved.
I can't wait. InfoWars, we're coming for you. Yeah, but this was a show that kind of knocked...
By the way, InfoWars, that's Kevin that's coming for you. That's not me. So I have... You guys, you do you.
Oh, that's right. You're pitching NRA. I'm pitching InfoWars.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It will be like Nerdist and Earwolf kind of fighting for the same piece of real estate.
Same comedians.
I want to talk about the season of Broad Strokes. One of the things we've started doing is at the end of each episode, we would give our Mazel Tovs... To the things, come on, give me a break.
Okay.
Mazel Tovs to the things we like. And we'd give our Schlemazels to the things that didn't quite work for us or didn't do it for us.
Okay.
For instance, I think our biggest Schlemazel of the season was all of the Sophie Lennon business. Jane Lynch as the fake fat comedian who turned into an SNL character of like aristocracy and inviting Midge into her place.
With the butler.
With the butler.
Yeah, that I agree was unnecessary.
But I do want to ask you as a performer, as someone who maybe doesn't even necessarily do stand-up, but just as someone who's been performing for a while.
Sure.
How did the show strike you on that level in the sense of its authenticity or how it strayed away from like the conventions of how we see performance portrayed in TV shows and movies?
I thought it was interesting. There were parts of it that I enjoyed and parts that I didn't. You know, it kind of, not that I didn't, rather, there are parts that rang true and some that didn't. You know, like the season kind of charts a stand-up comedian's growth from zero, true zero, to like, holy shit, she's like the real deal.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a little bit predicated on Midge having a... just a presentational style in life. You know, like she's doing stand up whether she knows it or not when she's talking at her wedding, at parties. She's already holding people's attention. She's already a natural gifted storyteller. All those things we know and we know about her. And it was very earned, I felt like, how they got into the. I loved the pilot storyline of Joel wanting. To be being so desirous and solicitous of a career in stand-up, even though he's just like a kind of, you know, ad man, kind of man in a gray flannel suit type.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, and it's great. I love that she is supporting him and giving him notes. You see her being engaged with comedy because of him, you know, and then he cheats on her and leaves her, and it's revealed that he's been stealing Bob Newhart's act the whole time. Right? It's Bob Newhart or is it Shelley Berman?
It's Newhart.
It's Newhart.
Yeah.
Who stole Shelley Berman's act.
Is that true? Ah, there's an Inception level to
there this. There is an Inception level.
Oh,
there
wow.
is there is a there is something funny. Now let me be very clear. That is a controversial. Bob Newhart did not steal Shelley Berman's act. Bob Newhart did the one-sided telephone call bit.
Right.
That Shelley, with different specifics, with different jokes, that Shelley, that device Shelley Berman, I believe, had been doing.
But it's basically the same format.
I'm repeating, I believe Shelley Berman thinks Bob Newhart stole his act.
I see, okay.
I'm not speaking, now I don't want to get in trouble with Bob Newhart or Shelley Berman, RIP.
It'd be like if someone started a bad movie podcast before How Did This Get Made.
Well, they did.
I
believe they did.
I think there's a few.
For sure.
Were you super into stand-up growing up as a kid?
I was because I was into comedy.
Yeah.
I was into comedy and comedy in any shape or form. Sure. You know, I was as into, at the time, it was like records. You would buy, you know, Steve Martin records. You would buy Stephen Wright records, or tapes. And I would listen to like comedy albums while I mowed the lawn or whatever. And then I would also watch, you know, SNL or when they started playing Monty Python on TV, all of those things. Carol Burnett Show was like, to me, my first exposure, I think, to sketch comedy was probably Carol Burnett or the Muppets, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was obsessed with both of them. Right. I was into stand-up. I was into, like all those kind of comedians of that era,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then eventually as I got old, and then Eddie Murphy came out and kind of blew up the whole thing, you know, in terms of like, oh, that was like that was a real moment of like, oh no, this is like, we're doing this, you know? Because prior to that, I feel like I used to listen to old, like my dad's old comedy records, which were more of the kind of Newhart, Nichols and May era of things.
Yeah, which the Newhart, Nichols and May stuff, it almost felt like, and I'd put the Mel Brooks 2000-Year-Old Man or whatever it's called, those almost function as like the proto-podcast that we have now.
Yeah.
In the sense of like the function, not so much the stand-up albums, but the function of what the podcasts are, where it's like people riffing and clearly enjoying each other and improvising some sort of thing. That was like the beginning of that.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's like a devaluing of that and of just like stand-up comedy in general, because there is so much free stuff.
There's also just a lot of stories, you know, like a lot of those early records, a lot of those were like story jokes, not like one-liners and zingers. Then you get into, and what's featured in the show, party records.
Yeah.
You know, your Red Fox records, those records that are much more kind of jokes, dirty jokes, like crowd work, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That I didn't get exposed to until like, I don't know, college, maybe even older than that. As a performer, I felt like, the thing that made me nervous going into it was the Lenny Bruce character.
Sure.
They were going to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've called him the Hitler of this show because he functions the same way as Hitler does in Glorious Bastards.
Yeah.
In the sense of like, okay, well, let's just take this real fictional person and do whatever we want with him.
Yeah. With the exception that his act is his act.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate to what those he actually
are
did his, back
those
then.
Those are, you know, they're on record as saying anytime he's on stage speaking, Lenny Bruce said those exact same words.
Sure.
You know?
I do find that actor compelling, though.
I thought it was totally fine.
He was really good.
I was nervous about it, and I was like, this is used the right amount, you know? Any more, and it would have bothered me.
Yeah, and we've put in behind us in the rearview mirror the whole idea of teams and the boyfriends and Rory stuff and who cares. That being said,
we put those behind us?
We've put those behind us.
Why?
Because the show is done.
Oh, I'm still Team Jess.
Okay.
Cool.
But I'm saying we've put the debate.
I'm still Team This Is Us.
Team This Is Us. I'm Team Crockpot, if you ask me. Do you watch that show?
I don't.
Okay. But I will ask you, Team Lenny or Team Joel, as far as this show goes?
Oh, are we shipping Lenny and Midge?
I'm shipping Lenny and Midge way harder than...
I'm Team Neither. Okay. This is one where I am like... I very much was glad that Midge's future romance was not a plot line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I felt like also because I'm not quite sure, but my guess would be that this whole season takes place in a very short amount of time.
In 72 hours.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, no, it seems very compressed.
It's very compressed timeline. So I think, you know, especially for that time period, and all of what's going on, I do believe, I don't know, but I do believe Midge would primarily be focused on the picking up her life after the divorce or the separate, all of that. Like the idea, I'm glad we didn't get distracted into a new love, romantic comedy kind of element. Because I was like, I don't want that. Like I want for her to be on her heels, for a character who has had everything, who we're being told has led a fairly charmed life and has gotten exactly what she wanted, for her to be like on her heels for that first season, trying to find a way to kind of pick herself up and not just get back to where she was, but to actually really get the lay of the land and realize, oh, I'm not where I want to be at all. Like there are there are many other things that I should want or would want were I to have my eyes open to wanting them. I really enjoyed that being the emotional journey for her. And not just the emotional journey is her and Joel, but how much the implosion of her marriage with Joel forces her to then reengage in the emotional complexities of her child-parent relationship. Sure, having to move back in with her parents and all of that, I thought was also like a very interesting way to keep emotions high without dwelling on the same emotions, you know?
Yeah.
That way in which like Midge's divorce kind of becomes infectious, is kind of a contagion that kind of starts to spread to her friends and to her parents, and to it starts to have a ripple effect, and she's a much more compelling character in this period of chaos.
Yeah, and there's so many beats in the finale of the show that remind me of like Lorelai Christopher reuniting stuff, where it's like, oh, this kind of, I get it, but it kind of feels gross and it doesn't feel right.
Oh, I loved that moment where she and Joel spend the night together.
Oh, with the bra straps.
I was like,
and the,
this is terrible.
Yeah.
This is the worst idea. And in a very good way, in a very human way. And that's what I like about Amy Sherman-Palladino in general, is that she's constantly allowing these characters to make mistakes and to make when they made a mistake, to not have a epiphany and crawl right out of it, to actually oftentimes go deeper
and dwell,
and really make things much worse for themselves. And I think like she's done that to great success, I think, between Lorelai and Emily. Mm-hmm. I feel like that whole relationship is the strongest relationship in the show to me, in Gilmore Girls. So in this too, I feel like everything, as Midge starts to grow in some ways, she's, you know, by making new friends and going and getting a job and doing the things and trying to do the stand-up and all this stuff, she's also making mistakes that are making things harder at home or in, you know, she's also, it's not all good. She's not all doing it correct, which I like the complicated mess that this show is, which I thought was very satisfying.
Yeah, and it feels like the first time where the primary question about the character in terms of her professional career does seem
interesting. And that primary question being, what's her cup size?
Yeah, the primary question being A, B, C, or D.
Just in case anybody's forgotten that I'm a real perv.
There's some real goy on goy action in this podcast today.
All you weirdos listening, don't forget, just a horny dude.
There's a lot of sweet people here to learn about Jewish culture and the faith from religious scholars Jason Mandzukas.
Oh, yeah.
And Kevin T. Porter. But
KTP?
KTP, but you're not going to get that today.
Nope.
But I do like that the primary question seems to be about career rather than relationship.
100%.
Because Lorelai's, it was like, she's got professional on, like, the trajectory's here. She's going to do Dragonfly.
Nobody doubts that the Dragonfly is going to be a hit.
Yeah. But that it's intertwined with the relationship stuff is interesting, and especially the way it functions with her name, the name Mrs. Maisel. That is the last beat.
Yep.
Of the whole season.
Yes.
That she says, I am Mrs. Maisel. Meanwhile, Mr. Maisel's out punching drunk people in the snow and stuff.
Oh, Joel.
Yeah, that was brutal. Let's talk about Joel. Because for me, it's brought up in a lot of these conversations a weird sense of insecurity. Because I feel like it's an interesting thing to see reflected truthfully in a show like this. Not literally truthfully, but emotionally truthfully. To see someone look at his side to someone he's supposed to be with, or he feels like he needs to be with romantically, and feel like he doesn't measure up and he doesn't know how to be in a support role, in a support mode, and especially when they want the same thing. So it's not like you're an accountant, I'm an artist, we're different, but like going after roughly the same things, or that he wants to be.
Well, not even realizing it.
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like it's baked into their marriage, and you know, like it's before she even ever thinks about doing comedy, before he even knows she does comedy. He doesn't know until the end, but he is just cascading down a spiral of coming to real grips with the fact that he is not talented.
Yeah.
You know, and that he is so desirous of that and so wants that, but that he cannot do it. he is bad. He is, and his insecurity makes him, and this was the one thing that I had a little trouble with in the show is I really thought that this character did a great job being insecure, representing effectively why he is. I struggled at a certain point to find why they were together, why she couldn't see the flaws enough to realize he was wrong for her.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, he was almost too weak and insecure for me to believe they would get all the way to getting married.
Oh, you weren't charmed by watching them at Bryn Mawr dance together and saying,
exactly.
Oh, you need something more. You deserve something more, baby.
No. That's the only thing I was missing. He seemed like to me to be patently like beneath her in terms of like being able to hang, being on the same wavelength.
Sure.
You know? But I guess that's part of it, you know?
I think it's part of it.
It is.
Because even the move, and we've talked about this before, but the move of her like getting up in the morning and putting on the makeup and priming herself and all that stuff, it's weirdly a power move and a move of like, oh, I'm in control of this situation. I have,
you know,
something of an upper hand. So there is a comfort.
Here's what I would have liked.
Yes.
Here's what I would have liked. I think it did not surprise me at all that he was bad at stand-up comedy.
Sure.
And that he was stealing someone's act. I think maybe I would have liked it a little bit more if he'd seemed slightly more capable in the beginning so that fall would have been a little bit more of like a discovery.
Yeah, that he was good at something.
That he was, like maybe if he'd been like pretty good at his job or which he kind of is later or whatever. But I don't know. I mean, this is very, very nitpicky because I truly love everything about this show.
Sure.
But there was this element of a little bit that he seemed from the jump just like, and I was like, oh, yeah. Well, he has to be, which is good. But I don't know. There was a little bit of like, I wish there had been a little bit more in that first episode or those first couple of, a little bit more. Like, there is no way that I ever, it was like, they'll get back together.
Yeah.
And I liked that. But there was a way in which I wanted it to like ring a little bit more like, ooh, what about him does hold her?
Mm-hmm.
What about him does, you know, for her, rather than just like comfort or whatever, what is it that, you know, I don't know.
And I think you're meant to see that a little bit in the flashbacks and see like, oh, there was a charm, there was a energy to like their young relationship, like at the wedding when he's like, oh, I'm going to marry you all over again because you hired these dancers and I'm in love with you and blah, blah, blah. But I agree with you that there's not enough of us seeing Joel through Midge's eyes to be able to totally be on board with like, oh yeah, keep going, Midge. And like,
also because like whenever once it all starts to happen, we see Joel through everybody's eyes.
Yeah.
And he's lacking for everybody. Her parents,
feels like it, yeah.
His Kevin Pollak himself is like disappointed, you know? And he's disappointing not just because he's weak and callous and incapable of like being a man, but he's also just like he cannot even measure up to that level of belief in himself that Midge has in him, you know, and that is heartbreaking. And I like that. But there was a part where I'm like, oh, he can't even try, though. He's like, this guy's really just like
a zero.
Yeah.
And it was hard to get on board with that. Because even in his like,
and there's no way he's good at sex.
Oh, you don't think?
No, he's like Dean level. He's
Dean like, level, just like, he's like Dean limpy level. Wet. Like,
this guy should just go straight to Supernatural.
oh, that's the spinoff.
Yep.
Wow. Joel's going to be like, all right, Midge, I can't hang. I'm going to California where I'm going to become some sort of immortal creature.
What should happen in season two is you see him walk into a portal.
Yeah.
And then in an episode of Supernatural, which inexplicably is still on the air
still
now.
Still on. Oh, those kids are making bank.
The portal opens, he pops out.
Yeah. Oh, no, I love it.
And they're like, oh, don't worry, bro. You're where you belong.
He's the new Big Bad. I love that interpretation because especially that is the one part of the show. Actually, I will say his performance wasn't my favorite, but my least favorite character to watch because I find the portrayal of masculinity, especially in the context of the 50s and in that marriage, to be interesting.
Oh, well, and I think it's no mistake that he is like the anti Don Draper.
Yeah.
They like, I feel like they put him into that world, a world we now are so acutely aware of from Mad Men, that we put him in the exact same time period, in the exact same business, in those exact same suits and offices and all of it. And you just show him eating shit.
Yeah.
You know, he's just a drip. He's a zero, as you said. And that's, I think, I don't know if it is, but I would guess they did that on purpose to be like, this juxtaposition couldn't be more clear how lacking he is, how uncharismatic he is, how unconvincing he is, how not Don Draper he is.
Do you feel like there's any way the show doesn't improve if they make Joel a recurring character or just a guest star in season two?
If I were them, I would just keep, I would have him in half the episodes, if yeah, that. Yeah. I don't think, and by the way, I think that's the right move.
Yeah.
I don't think, I would hope that we are not bound to a story about Midge and Joel.
But it does feel like it for the amount of episodes where they just follow Joel. And it's like, yep, see, look at him in Penny Pan with the empty seats next to them at the music.
I did like that stuff. That's the stuff that I thought was really interesting, actually, about Joel. The stuff that made Joel interesting was the stuff with Penny.
Yeah.
Those were the moments where I was like, okay, now we're showing Joel, like, having to make choices.
Yeah.
Having to really, you're watching him work stuff out because he's a dummy. And that was interesting, mm-hmm, you know?
Original casting choice for Penny, Bailey DeYoung.
Really?
Miss Jenny, your top bun.
Oh,
yeah.
Jenny.
Imogen.
Oh, I love her.
In this show.
She might be my top bun.
Yeah.
I mean, her or Boo. Love that Boo.
Where's Boo? Come on, give Boo a shot in season two.
Where is Boo?
Where is Boo?
That's a t-shirt.
She's haunting us. Where is Boo?
Where is Boo?
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Now, unlike anything I've ever talked about on the air, I actually stand by Squarespace. I actually do, because I've used it for everything I've made. Literally, GilmoreGuysShow.com, the very website for this very podcast, was made using Squarespace. How beautiful is that? KevinTPorter.com, I made that using Squarespace. My old bake shop website, that was made using Squarespace. Because you can do it all with Squarespace. You can sell content on your website. So exclusive stuff behind a paywall. You can sell memberships, courses, or sell files your customers can download, like PDFs, music, or ebooks. You can do that with Squarespace. You can do analytics with Squarespace, so you can figure out who's visiting your website and why, and figure out how to get traffic and where's it coming from. You can also have people do flexible payments on Squarespace. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accepts credit cards, PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. How nice is that? You can also do email campaigns, so there's constant outreach for your stuff and people know where to find you. So I'm going to let you know where to find Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now let's talk about your social battery. Maybe right now it's bursting at the seams with energy. Maybe it's a little drained. Maybe you're one of those people like my friend with their phone battery that keeps it 2% all the time, even when they stay home all day. And they definitely could charge up if they wanted to, but they don't. Well, regardless of where it is, it's important to understand why it is the way it is. Why is the battery low when it gets low? Is it because you're feeling less social? Is it because you're feeling sad? Is it because of emotions you've yet to identify? Or maybe just boundaries you haven't set for yourself yet? Either way, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves too thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, maybe you don't. Maybe you need a little more alone time. Well, either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. This is so important because I've been in therapy for 10 plus years, for some would say, technically, 11 years this month, and it's helped me so much understand where I get my energy from, how I use my energy, how to better use my energy, and how to maintain things in a way that's sustainable and healthy and good. And that's to do, of course, with boundaries, but also just understanding who I am and what I want. and I couldn't have done so much of that work without therapy. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GilmoreGuys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GilmoreGuys.
Okay, let's talk about the parents. Let's talk about Abe.
Shalhoub.
Rose. Rose for me was the weak spot of this whole season. Rose, I didn't...
Of the whole season?
Of the whole season.
Oh, interesting.
In the sense of not like it failed anytime they showed her, but I just...
Yeah.
I didn't understand what her thing was. I didn't understand, other than like kind of repeating beats of Emily Gilmore's Shadow, in the sense of like, oh no, this is how things are done and this is how we want you to look to society and culture, blah, 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 blah. Other than that, and just like a slightly different Jewish mother twist on it, I didn't see what was interesting about that relationship. Whereas with Abe, listen, that's, to me, that's MVP of the season.
Oh, Shalhoub is... dynamite
on
in this
fire
show.
From minute one.
Absolutely great. He is great.
He's... Absolutely great is what you said. Is that what you said?
I did not say that.
I misheard you. I'm so sorry.
You did mishear me. Can I leave? Am I allowed to leave?
Anytime you want. Although we do have tickets to the Great Showman at the Glendale Americana.
Oh, God. Oh, wait. I have to go to Glendale to see this terrible movie?
Glendale Americana is all right. It's all right for a matinee.
Oh, boy. Shalhoub, great. I actually enjoyed the dynamic, especially between the parents, you know. I thought it was, you know, again, because we're playing a lot with similar themes that they have played with in Gilmore Girls especially, mm-hmm. Bunheads to a slightly less degree. But I really liked the complexity, or not the, I mean, it's not like super complex, but I like that the relationship between the parents itself became a storyline, and it wasn't just that they were an opposing force that existed together.
Sure.
You know, like, it's not Emily and Richard just rubber stamping whatever Emily says. Mm-hmm. There is actually a storyline between Abe and Rose, did you say?
Yeah.
That is itself interesting, and that is itself, what I felt like the show did a really good job of was telling a smaller story that is constantly rippling, the effects of which are rippling through all the relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of cause and effect.
Each time someone does something to someone, that person pays it forward to somebody else. And the whole thing starts to like really be a snake eating its own tail in a really good way. Yeah. I really enjoyed, as the season went on, watching everybody's relationship kind of fall into disarray as they reacted to Midge, kind of what Midge, as they reacted to Midge, really, what Midge was doing.
Yeah.
And whether that's Joel or whether that's the parents or whether it's her friends or whether it's, and we haven't even talked about
Miss Susie.
Yeah, exactly. And all of the world of the I don't remember what's
Gaslight.
It is the Gaslight.
Yeah,
okay.
It is. I know, I keep wanting to call it the Gaslight Anthem. It's just the Gaslight.
No, it's just the Gaslight. Well, I also was like, it might have been Café Wa.
Yeah.
Because they're both
side by side.
Real.
In Greenwich Village, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They're both real spots. And I liked that too. And I liked that they gave little winks to all the acts that you see are references to
a real life counterpart.
You know, this is the same for, if I'm sure you guys have talked about it at some point, this is the same Greenwich Village scene that Inside Llewyn Davis portrayed.
Yeah.
This is the Greenwich Village scene of like the folk boom, you know, the hootenanny scene that is like, that is, you know, Joan Baez and Ramblin' Jack Elliott and Tim Van Ronk. Yeah. And then Dylan comes, steals Tim Van Ronk's whole scene, steals Fred Neil, steals from everybody, and then becomes Bob Dylan and blows the whole thing up.
Yeah. Someone just watched No Direction Home.
But it's such a vibrant, interesting time of counterculture, of stuff that is happening. And I thought they did a very good job, like, kind of representing that, wherein, like, stuff, you could get pulled off stage, arrested, and put in jail. Like, that's cool. That's exciting. I liked that there was stakes to it, and
sure.
it felt cool. Sorry, I'm in the we're in the middle of something else though.
We're talking about the parents, but
Oh, I really loved them. I thought it was a great, and I loved Joel's parents as well, Kevin Pollak, and I'm spacing the actress who plays
Shirley Manson.
Thank you.
No, Shirley, I forget her name as well.
She I thought they were great as well. Like I was very on board for all of the parents. When Midge comes out and finds that her mom has forced Abe out of his study into the living room and has reclaimed the dining room as the dining room. Like I just loved, and that then we sat in that for a while. And there were, it provided Shalhoub, who is doing like this very kind of head-based academic kind of character, to do a whole bunch of weird physical comedy because he's trapped behind all these books and has to climb over them. And I was like, this is great. I love it.
It is one of the most musical theater performances.
And his whole thing about like the job and like pretending like he doesn't want the job and then turning. Yeah. I loved it. I thought he had really great. A really great arc, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and to your point, it does feel like one of the better plotted seasons of any Paladino show.
100%.
Because you boil it down just to the bare bones of the plot.
I think Rose has to speak to what you were saying earlier, has a thankless job because she is, for better or worse, representing a point of view that has to act in opposition to Midge. Midge has to be shown to be braver than her mother.
Mm-hmm.
She has to be shown to be someone who for whom her mother is someone who says, who believes you can't do any of these things. These will ruin you. Were you to be divorced? Were you to be an unmarried woman? Were you to be, if this is what befalls you, your life is over. The mother has to speak for a kind of antiquated, she has to speak for the point of view that Midge has to act in opposition to, which makes her seem weaker and makes her seem not as dynamic, wherein she is, you know, it's a troublesome character because, mm-hmm. you know, it seems as though she's not believing in her daughter. And it seems as though she believes, which I think she does, that women cannot succeed in the way that Midge now wants to. And there's a way in which her dad reluctantly kind of, there is a way in which he's rooting for her,
mm-hmm.
where you're seeing, where her mom you are constantly being shown is not, you know, in a way.
Yeah, it is a thankless role.
And that's a tough role. And I thought she did, I liked her performance. I thought it was great. And I liked that dynamic between the two of them. It's almost as if Amy Sherman-Palladino is trying to work a mother-daughter thing out.
I don't see that. I've never seen that.
Maybe she and Wes Anderson should make a movie together.
No, I'll dine this.
Mothers and daughters, fathers and sons.
Wait, Wes Anderson has daddy issues? Oh, boy. As far as Susie goes, I found this to be one of the most, we haven't quite seen this before in a Paladino thing.
Yes.
Because it's not just a Suki reprise.
It's not.
Especially because Borsing was Suki in the original pilot of the show. But
I forgot that.
It's not just that. It's something where the motivation, her motivation isn't primarily friendship. It's glory in a weird way. It is professional success and holding Midge's hand in this weird underworld that they're both trying to navigate together.
Yeah.
How did that performance strike you?
It struck me pretty good. Here's what was tough, I will say about it. And I'm trying to think of it like, it's a hard thing because I felt like they did such a good job setting us in the Upper East Side, Upper West Side, Jewish enclave of Manhattan, and that world and those families and those apartments and the rabbi and the papa, setting us in that when you then go downtown to the Gaslight, that didn't feel as real to me for a while.
It felt a little more cartoony and broad.
It felt a little bit more, it felt like a little broader to me. Okay. That world just felt more, because partially it is, performative. You know, it didn't feel as comfortable.
Grounded.
You know, it didn't feel as grounded as all the family stuff. And so it took me a while to get into that stuff. You know, I really liked the storyline of watching Midge get better at performing. I liked, and it's, honestly, like there were times when I liked more when they went out to other places to perform. Those, like when they went to the strip club.
Sure.
I liked those elements of it. There was something about the Gaslight that for whatever reason, it felt a little bit more like a set to me. You know, like a soundstage set. It felt, it just didn't immediately convert to being like, yep, that belongs in the same world as that apartment we just left.
That's so interesting because I found the way more compelling story of this season to be, because it felt like twin narratives of Midge's rise and success and then the fallout from the divorce or separation from Joel. And I found anytime we got away from that, Shalhoub aside, anytime we got away from that and we just focused on like the Midge and Susie stuff, because there's a few episodes where it seems primarily dedicated to that and devoted to just the professional and the careers and stuff. I found that to be a little more compelling of a watch overall, just because
it
felt more like a journey and an adventure.
It's a forward, the forward momentum is 100% in that.
Yeah.
But because of the way it was structured, it is the aside.
Yeah, you know I get what I mean? That, yeah.
And it becomes the central thrust as this show goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved their relationship as it grew, you know? And I loved the Susie characters, her own personal, all the specifics of her life.
Yeah.
How heartbreaking her life is, the apartment
her
that she lives
apartment.
In.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
phone calls at the newsstand, you know, all the type... hand-typed business cards. I thought, and I thought Alex Borstein's portrayal was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It just took me a while, and I think the Lenny Bruce was a little bit part of this too. It took me a while to let that world sink in, maybe it's because Midge herself doesn't fit into it. It felt ill-fitting for a while.
I get
you
that.
Know?
Yeah.
And this gets back to your question earlier about performance. I found that, you know, the performances that I liked the most were the ones that were accidental, the first one, or struggling, you know?
Oh, when she was kind of bombing and she was just trying to recount her day and people weren't buying
because
it.
Because what I was very afraid of was that she would just be a natural, you know? And it's very true that she is naturally funny.
Yeah.
And that she is a natural in the world, like at parties or at her wedding and what, like what we were talking about before. But that it's a different thing to actually write and hone jokes or an act or like it is a actually very different. It's not just being funny that makes you a good stand-up comedian.
Sure.
And so I was nervous and even still was like a little bit like, I don't know how easy did that just come,
mm-hmm.
you know, in
mm-hmm.
terms of, again, this gets back to timeline, you know, and of course we're telling a narrative and this is like a bit of storytelling and all that stuff. But like for her to go from like drunkenly ranting on stage to like Lenny Bruce introducing her at the end of the season to having whatever she's got now, an hour or 15 minutes. I don't know what. To have something that is so well executed already, that was the only thing. I was like, ooh. And that, which is why I was glad they had her struggle and stuff. But one of the things that was tough was some of her struggles were successes. Like one of her biggest struggles is because she's speaking truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And taking down Sophie.
The whole Sophie set.
Sophie Jane Lynch.
I think when we talked about it in the room, it struck all of us as a false no because it
didn't
was
make
too
sense.
Mean. It was too removed.
Mean. It didn't make sense to me. And it also was she was being punished for telling the truth.
Yeah.
And I didn't like that. Like, I didn't like that her greatest fall was itself a success or was her integrity.
Oh, yeah.
Or
it
her,
was,
you know?
Yeah.
I would rather she have been bad.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather she have been, I would rather, you know what it is? I would rather that act had been
a mediocre.
She's bombing. She's bombing, and because she's bombing, she attacks Sophie.
Yeah.
Sophie, right? Jane Lynch's character, Sophie.
Lennon.
Yeah. I would rather that attack came from a place of weakness rather than a place of strength.
Sure.
Because then you have the same punishments befall her, which I think is good.
Mm-hmm.
I think I don't mind that she takes those shots, but the reason she takes them, I did not agree with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would rather that had come from, there's almost like Midge is, if there is a criticism for me for the show, Midge is too good at everything.
It's pretty magical.
Always.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, even when she's knocked down a peg, she's good at it. Like, and that's the bummer. The bummer is like, I would rather have seen her have real struggles to get better mm-hmm. and to work. And this is me as a comedian. I would have liked to have seen more process. I would have liked to have seen more of, I would have loved in the middle of this season to have tracked one joke's growth.
And they showed a little bit of that in that montage. Yes. And that was cool. Yeah.
You know, but I was like, no, let's see why this works and this doesn't. Or why something, you know, they touch on a little bit. Why something that works at a party doesn't work on stage? Mm-hmm. Why? What mm-hmm. is that? And maybe, again, that's just maybe people are screaming at their radios. No, I don't want to see that.
Their radios?
Everybody's listening.
Their FM radios?
Everybody's tuned into this on a transistor radio under the covers, right? By the way, horny moms out there.
Oh, hashtag horny moms is still trending.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
Are we still trending? Hashtag horny
Jason
moms?
Jason checks it every day just to make sure.
I check it, yeah, just to see what's what. See
you guys are out there.
Horny moms are trying to tweet at me.
Well, and that's,
again, if you're a horny mom and you want to tweet at me about how horny you are.
Or if your mom's not horny.
Kevin, what's your Twitter?
What's my Twitter? Yeah. It's at Kevin T. Porter.
Yep. Currently. You just tweet at Kevin all your horny fantasies about me.
Sure.
And he will pass them along.
You know,
The hornier, the dirtier, the better. Just tweet him at, what's it again, Kevin?
At Kevin T. Porter.
At Kevin T. Porter.
You may be surprised to know this is already happening and has been happening for the last 2 years
is
we've been
really?
Doing. No. I mean, no, people do tell us things about you that they want us to pass on. And
great.
Sometimes we do and sometimes we don't.
Perfect.
But one of the things, getting into process, because that seemed to be like one of the most fun things to talk about this season for you, I thought about you, especially when they were talking about when Susie was talking to Midge about bombing and just, yeah, it's a fact of life. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're going to do it a billion times.
Oh, yeah.
You're someone who I've always known to embrace the bomb, to love the bomb,
sure.
to dig into the bomb. How long did it take you to get there, though? Because you probably didn't start out that way.
I didn't start out that way, but I have never been. I've never been rattled by it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if it's that maybe I heard that or understood that to be the case, you know, that bombing is part of it, you know, and it's not that I enjoy it or anything like that, but I never, you know, I did a show at UCB in 1999 or 2000 maybe, for like over a year. That was an improv show.
Was this you and Sinclair?
No. Okay. This was a terrible show, and it ran every week for a year, over a year. It was called Cartoon Chaos, and it was an improvised. This was an era in which a lot of improv themed improv shows were based on a format. So like there was the movie form, there was all of these things that were like, we're going to improvise a courtroom drama, we're going to improvise a movie, we're going to whatever. And this one was, we're going to improvise a kid's morning cartoon show was the thrust of it.
Mm-hmm.
We did, I mean, over a year, we probably did 70 some odd, you know, shows. Maybe two of them worked. It was terrible every week. We ate shit every week.
Silence.
Just like barely scraping by. It was awful. But we got so much better. We got so much better as improvisers, so much better in like just working with this form, working with all of it. And it was invaluable, I think, in order to like keep me engaged and being a better improviser. That being said, I didn't enjoy those shows. It didn't make me feel good mm-hmm. to go out and eat shit every week, but I went every week, like, stoked to get on that stage, ready to figure it out, ready to try and figure it out. And I played, just for full disclosure, I played the leader of the cartoon crime-solving team.
Oh, dear God.
Ricky Martin. It was awful. It was awful.
And it was the Ricky Martin. You were doing a Ricky Martin impression.
It was Ricky Martin and the Loka Power Team. And it was like a kid's cartoon, kind of like the old, like Harlem Globetrotters
or Scooby-Doo
or whatever. We're a team. It was me, somebody playing Woody Allen, somebody playing a Klingon. Billy Merritt played a Klingon. Jessica Chaffin played Chelsea Clinton. Danielle Schneider came in and played, was my co-leader, Kathy Griffin. Kathy Lee Gifford. Thank you. She was Kathy Lee Gifford. John Daly played Sappity Tappity, the sentient pine tree that sounds like Peter O'Toole. James Eason played the android, Mogo. It was like mental. It was crazy.
You kept the characters every show?
Every show, same characters.
Why?
Who knows? Anyway, it was a terrible show. But bombing is huge. And it also was like that in and of itself was a huge lesson. Like, it does not bother me if people don't like what we're doing for a moment. If, like, I will sit in discomfort for I don't know how long, like
sure.
It's, that's fine, you know? It's like, I'm here. I'm, like, on the stage. I've already gotten here.
Yeah,
you've already gotten to your seat. I'm already on the stage. So whatever's happening is the show.
You have a lot of
even
presence
if it's
of
bad,
mind. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And as improv, and I will say this, this is, like, just to draw a very clear line between improv and stand-up, I can adjust, as stand-ups can as well, but I can very fluidly adjust. If I'm bombing, I can speak to my bombing. I can lean into my bombing. I can change the show.
You can make story moves
in
a way
that
you
want.
Couldn't.
If yeah. I'm doing 10 minutes of stand-up comedy that is pre-written and you know, that I've decided what I'm going to do for my 10 minutes, that's what, if my first joke eats shit, I know what jokes I have, you know,
yeah.
that coming up. If I, as a stand-up, I can either shift around in my mind and try and figure, oh, wait, I'm not where I want to be at the end of that joke, so the start of this joke might be,
yeah.
You know, I can, or there are certainly plenty of stand-ups who can improvise and be quick on their feet, do crowd work, whatever, try and get the crowd on. But sometimes people, once they start eating shit, they're like, oh, the next 10 minutes are going to be miserable.
Did you ever want to try stand-up? Ever? Or did it never appeal?
It never quite appealed to me. The yeah. times I've done it in one capacity or another.
You did try one.
Very, no, like I just hosted the Sundance Film Festival Awards show.
Oh, this right? is recently?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so in order to host the show, they were like, will you do like 10 minutes at the top of jokes, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, yeah, of course. That's how these work, of course. So I'll do, you know, I'll do jokes. And so I wrote stand-up and did it
wow.
for this thing. And now that's very specialized. I wrote jokes about the Sundance Film Festival, which I had just done, to the Sundance Film Festival audience. It's not like...
You were preaching to the choir.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I wrote jokes for that crowd. I didn't write jokes and I tell them to any crowd. It's a little bit of a different setup, but... Each and I've done a few things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've never tried just stand up. I've never tried to sit, write jokes.
So I'm dating again,
and then go up and go up at an open mic or whatever. I've never tried that. But the times I've done even what I have done, I've not enjoyed it that much. I really like being on stage with someone else
and building something
and
together.
Building something together yeah. in the moment. I find that for me. To be very rewarding and very compelling. Standing on stage alone with just me and material,
yeah,
it's fine, but I just don't enjoy it as much.
Yeah,
you know, I really like having someone to bounce off of. I like having the truthful moments that are found organically as you're kind of building something together. That sense of discovery and surprise. I find to be both as a performer and as an audience member really exciting.
Yeah.
And so I'm always trying to pursue that.
I mean, does that make it tough as a writer then when you do stuff alone? Because
to write alone?
Because you don't.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have a partner.
I don't. No, no, I don't. And it is very hard. My least favorite thing is writing.
Yeah.
Is because it is in just completely solitary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It is the most torturous part of my career, you
yeah.
know, as the people who have hired me to write scripts can tell you, because it takes me so much longer than it ever should, because I just am allergic to it.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. That's probably a commonality with most people where they do five or six things. And this is always the hardest thing.
Yeah.
It's always the hardest thing to write by yourself.
Yeah.
That being said.
Bombing.
Bombing.
That's how we started, right?
Yeah.
I would have liked it if Midge bombed more.
Yeah.
If we really saw her struggle to have that end of season success.
Well, and I had
I never doubted her, really.
There was never a moment where it's like, ah, maybe she's not so marvelous.
Yeah.
This Mrs. Maisel. Especially when she stumbles into like the political rally at Washington yeah. Square Park or whatever it was, which was such a confused.
Yes.
I think that was the worst I mean, next to the Sophie Lynn stuff, that was the worst depiction of like her craft and her set, where she could just say general vagaries about women and not know what she's talking about per se, and people responded to her. That was the most like pixie dust, Lorelai Gilmore, Princess of Stars Hollow moment.
And that's kind of the stuff that I ended up being like, why was this necessary?
Yeah.
Like, why is it necessary to have her not just get a job, but like galvanize everyone around her at the job to be better people?
Yeah.
Like, and I get it. She's got this kind of golden touch, and she sees people for who they are, and this wonderful kind of like element to her, which is kind of magical, but it's a little bit too magic. I would have liked for her to be a little
more flawed,
and to have gotten a little grimier as she progresses, you know?
Oh, like a little more cynical after having done the process.
A little bit, not to wallow or to, but to really take those hits to heart, to really get rocked a little bit more than she does, you know? But that's, again, I'm nitpicking like emotional beats that are very likely there in some way, shape, or form that I just didn't feel hit hard enough for me. Like,
sure.
I really loved this show.
Yeah.
You know?
Those are all personal things.
Yeah.
Well, let's look back on the season one last time. Let's give our overall Maisel, Tovs, and Schlemazels for the whole season, for things we liked in particular, loved in particular, and things that didn't quite work for us. We can just sum it up. I can start.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I mean, I'm going to reiterate again, the biggest Maisel Tov to Tony Shalhoub for giving us something new and different and interesting in that depiction of a Jewish father.
Mm-hmm.
A huge Maisel Tov to the soundtrack and Mr. Daniel Palladino probably playing music supervisor all the way through. I give huge Maisel Tov to production design. Every frame of it felt like a weird, fun Norman Rockwell
painting. Really great. They did you're absolutely right. And they did it with a ton of exteriors. You know,
that's the big thing in period stuff.
That's the thing. When you watch Mad Men, and this is a fascinating juxtaposition.
Yeah.
When you watch Mad Men, Mad Men is an almost entirely interior shot show because it's so prohibitively expensive to shoot period exteriors, especially in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it all over this show. Huge.
Like when they don't need to.
Moving crane shots, full city blocks, cars, buildings. They are doing stuff in this show that like Mad Men can't touch.
Yeah.
You know? And listen, I think Mad Men is like one of like the singular greatest TV achievements of the last 10 years. They are doing stuff that is so, especially because if you watch like the Gilmore Girls revival, it looks terrible. You know,
it looks like it was terrible. Shot on like Sony DSLR. Yeah,
it is. This show is so wonderfully shot. It is so lush and beautiful and like such a rich portrayal of 50s New York. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are some of my Maisel Tovs. I give Schlemazel to the Sophie Lennon subplot. The kind of, I give still Maisel Tovs to the whole doing stand up at the party stuff. None of that really worked for me.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and especially
I'm going to give a shout out to my friend Nate Cordry.
Nate Cordry, who's good in the show.
Yep.
But the device to bring them together was so wild.
Yes.
Where it's like, oh, we're doing an improv scene now.
Well, the thing that bothered me about that a little bit, again, it's that she's so flawlessly good at everything that I was like, if you're going to now have a digression into, because, you know, like you've got the Sophie Lennon character who is one type of comedian at that time. Mm-hmm. And now you're going to show us like a little bit of a nod to the Nichols and May style, you know, banter, improvised storytelling, improvised performative scenes that were also very popular at this time,
mm-hmm.
Which I really like that they included that kind of comedy.
Yeah, the lens was... Yeah.
I did not like how it came about, you know? I did not like how it came about. I didn't like...
that he initiated in the middle of someone's living room.
Yeah. I also didn't like that she was workshopping stand-up in living rooms. Like, that she was... That whole subplot bothered
me. Well, especially because her stand-up up to that point was, here's what happened to my day, and here's kind of my take on it. And the stand-up in the living room stuff, or the comedy in the living room stuff was, what's the deal with living rooms?
And everybody was like, pissing their pants.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, there was a little, again, a lot of my nitpicks are within the comedy of, within like, not whether or not it was funny, but sure. within the actual approach to how to represent comedians. And so I loved that she is educating herself to what comedy is, like with the records. Like that to me, I was like, great. Give me more of that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see how listening to Red Fox records influences her next act. What does she try?
She does like a black voice.
Right. Like, yeah. But like, what about that? Or I would have also liked if they'd shown more comedians than just Lenny Bruce. Like, I would have loved it if we'd seen more people performing so we understood. Like, I almost feel like I wish those party scenes had been her seeing Nate Cordry doing comedy in the room.
Sure, yeah.
Or something. Like, I would have liked it if she was, if we got to see her, process. If we got to see her process more. If we got to see what listening to the records or seeing people, how that changed how she tried things for better or worse, you know? I would have, I guess, liked that. But again, I do think that is a very perhaps limited, I don't know how many people would have wanted to watch that as much as people would have wanted to watch the emotional journey of her family, her right. marriage dissolving, all that stuff, which in many ways took the spotlight because it was an intensely emotional storyline.
Sure.
But for me, I was like, ooh, I want more of how is she cracking writing? How is she figuring? Not that she's a natural, because her natural talent will only get her so far. And I would have loved to have seen the end of that and the struggle of how then to convert what is this natural font of talent into actual jokes, those jokes into an actual act,
yeah.
and how coming into contact with all of these different people, comedians on records, comedians in person, people to talk to about comedy, people in rooms, how all of these interactions made her better at it.
Yeah.
Not just that she's good at it from the beginning, she's good at it at the end, and all she needed was like,
a
little push.
Yeah.
That to me was a little bit like magical.
Yeah, but to see her as like more of a sponge in her environment, which is already so interesting,
yeah.
and to see her like disseminate just the raw information like, around her.
I would have loved if the last act, you know, was very reminiscent of the first act, but like the drunken rant. I would like it if the last act was similar, but we had seen it throughout the season go into different ways.
Yeah.
Go into different directions. Try on different styles.
Try this. I'm going to do this as a persona now.
That's how, as a comedian, you find your voice. It almost exists. It almost posits a world in which she arrived fully formed,
mm-hmm.
which I disagree with.
Yeah, because you didn't, certainly.
Nobody does.
You took a long time.
Nobody does. Yeah. You arrive with what you have, and then you make it yours.
Yeah.
Like, and you do that by imitating the people that you like, you know, like by stylistically choosing. Like, I chose to do improv because in my mind it lined up more with what I thought I would be good at,
yeah.
and what I liked and what made me most excited. I didn't do stand up because I didn't think I was going to be as good at writing jokes. I was like, I think I'm better like acting against other people, you know, like that to me is more interesting or more, I think that's going to, you know, each time you're always kind of as a comedian or as a musician, like you listen to like early records by musicians. And a lot of times you're listening to them interpret their influences. You're listening to young saxophonists sound like Sonny Rollins or John Coltrane,
mm-hmm.
or who their idols are, yeah. until they process it enough to be like, oh, my thing is actually this.
Yeah, you know? So it would be interesting to see her in like season 3 or season
yeah.
4 have a much different style and voice than she does in season 1, rather than just like the drunk set but not drunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, that's a show that is a much higher percentage about stand-up comedy
yeah.
than it is about this woman in her life. And I think this correctly is a show about this woman in her life, not
yeah.
a show exclusively about a woman becoming a stand-up comedian.
Well, I was kind of knocked out by the fact that, you know, it's probably the most overrepresented profession on TV right now.
Isn't that crazy?
Stand-up comedy.
How strange.
Yeah. It's a weird, wild world.
How strange. And interestingly, in dramas.
Yeah.
In shows that are one-hour dramas, you know, this is, you know, for the most part, you know, there is no sitcom about a stand-up.
Like a half-hour true sitcom.
That's just about somebody like Seinfeld.
There's no Seinfeld moment anymore. Yeah. Or like based on the comedy. Yeah.
But we've got like, you know, I'm Dying Up Here. That's what it's called, right?
Yeah.
We've got this. We've got like isn't there another 1 hour that's set in comedy?
Crashing is a half hour set in comedy.
Oh,
Stand
sure.
Up Pete Holmes show.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch.
It's pretty weird.
That being said, I find this to be one of the more interesting depictions of it.
Oh, very much so.
Even though it's not made by people who are stand-ups.
Yes. I will say that one of the things very smartly that they did was hire Jen Kirkman.
Yeah, she's a consultant.
To help write Midge's stand-up.
She worked on her stand-up particularly?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
That's my understanding. This is based, I'm not, I haven't talked to Jen Kirkman about this, but this is based on an interview that I heard Amy and Dan give, about having actual, it was important to them to have actual comedians help write the actual comedy, you know, the actual stand-up act. But I thought that I think this is a very compelling depiction, especially because it's very compelling both in style and you're watching something at a time in which there are almost no female stand-up comedians doing the kind of comedy that Midge is doing. You know, this is an era where Joan Rivers is about to kind of be doing stuff, and there's not the same. It's exciting to watch. This era, it's exciting to watch this self-possessed woman conquer this era of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought that was really exciting.
Yeah. So how about...
I'm supposed to be doing...
Some Maisel Tops or Schlemazels. You can just do one and one if you like.
No, I'm just trying to think. I'm going to give a couple shouts to... I really liked, again, I liked the world building of this. Like, I loved David Paymer, who is in there.
Terrific.
As the kind of successful comedy manager that Susie seeks out. Mm-hmm. And he represents Sophie Lennon. But he kind of comes in and out as this kind of wiser, more experienced person. But I thought he was great. I thought he was really interesting. I loved, I'm going to give shouts to my boy, the human fish, who is one of the...
The human fish? Oh, is he in the record shop?
He's one of the record shop boys.
Yeah.
He's a UCB New York guy. He's also known as the human fish on the Chris Gethard show. I liked that. Like, I liked the record store that is, like, you know, compiling a comprehensive, you know, a collection of everything that's happening in the hootenanny scene.
And production design porn for all the, like, background details frame. Yeah,
I loved it. I cannot stress enough how exceptional I thought Rachel Brosnahan was as someone who I know to be not from any kind of comedy background, and not from even any kind of like, she doesn't come from improv or sketch. She's just like a straight Broadway actor. And I thought she did an amazing job.
Mm-hmm.
She's amazing in the role, but then an amazing job doing comedy, you know, like doing actual comedy,
which is a really hard sell. It's not like, let's make Gwyneth Paltrow a country singer.
Yes.
It's like, oh, I buy it.
Yeah.
1,000%.
No, this was, and long, you know, takes of her doing stuff. And
mm-hmm.
So I thought she was pretty exceptional. My girl, Jenny.
Your girl, Jenny. Emma Jenny.
I did not love Joel. That's my real weak spot was Joel.
Yeah,
I'm spacing.
That's good,
you're right. I agree with you in what you said. Like, the soundtrack, I think, is dynamite.
Yeah.
I think it looks, sounds great. I think it is, to me, the single greatest percentage of wins in conception to execution of an Amy Sherman-Palladino show.
Yeah, because before, it seemed like the biggest attractional elements in her shows were going to be performances and then the script or the dialogue. And now it feels like, oh, now we have a visual to match it. Now
Everything.
We have a sound to match it.
The whole cast is, for the most part, undeniably great.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't people in there that you're like, okay, well. Yeah. I wish that was a better version
of
that.
I guess we'll get, yeah, exactly.
I guess this is what we get and we'll have to deal with it, you know? Yeah. And that's fine. And I also think we benefit from, you know, what did we watch? 10 episodes of this?
It was 8.
It was 8?
8 is enough in this case.
Exactly. Thank you, Dick Van Patten. Yeah, and, you know, like Gilmore is like, yo, they're doing 22 hours of television a year.
It's so much.
With
so much.
Commercial interruptions. And it's like, it's a different animal. So I, not that I want to compare these as if they are full equals. They are completely different animals. But this just never really disappointed me. There was I never watched an episode that I thought was like, meh. They didn't really make moves that I thought, even like the potholes that I saw, like the Lenny Bruce stuff, I was like, oh, I'm okay with this.
Yeah.
This does not bother me. If this was used more, it might. But it was just the right amount of stuff. There were a couple of moments that didn't ring true, or there were a couple things that I wish had been different or harder earned or whatever. But those are real nitpicks for what was otherwise, like, I just thought, a terrific season of television.
Yeah, and I think that's even speaking to Paladino love aside, because I feel like this is speaking to a whole different audience that Gilmore didn't get.
Because 100%.
In a weird way, when you remove all the post-1958 references and all this stuff, the dialogue's a little bit slower in a nice way, and obviously all the things we said about the visuals and whatnot. But it's really hard now, when there's so many new shows coming out every week, for something to, you know, talking about The Ringer or The Watch, for something to not just be kind of a B minus.
Yes.
For it to not be just like, yeah, it's good.
It's good.
It's good.
No, this I thought was really very good.
Yeah.
And I will say, I thought the dialogue was still pretty fast.
Yeah.
But in a very smart and good way, like, we have been conditioned to believe that people talked this fast in this time period.
Exactly.
Because of screwball comedies.
Yeah.
Because of Preston Sturgis, or because of those movies that may, you know, like Amy Sherman-Palladino has always been doing screwball comedies, but just set in modern day, when that kind of rat-a-tat-tat, His Girl Friday kind of dialogue is juxtaposed with a modern setting. We normally see it in old movies, and in this, we get a period piece, so it feels more organic that they're talking faster, even though, you know, it's not. It's,
totally.
It's a false, you know, it's false, but we believe it because movies have told us people talk this fast. Cary Grant talked this fast.
Yeah, there's a lot less cognitive dissonance than like, oh, why are the people on the WB backlot
exactly
talking like this?
Exactly, going a mile a minute. Yeah, blah, blah, you know? Blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah. Well, great. What do you want to see from season two?
I would like season two to start to shift the ratio of her life. You know, I would like it if this show became more of a show about Midge in the world of comedy and less a show about Midge's family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would like it if it was much more of an establishment as her of, as an individual, rather than her as part of this collect, being torn or pulled between all of these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, that's it. That's really it, which I think is kind of where it's pointed, if I'm not wrong.
So. Yeah, it feels like it'll be a more of a 70-30
like,
split.
Here's what I don't want. I don't want season two to be any more about Midge and Joel.
Yeah.
I would like for that to be put to bed. Like, I don't think that can be a ongoing will they, won't they. I think it needs, and I also don't need her to have a boyfriend, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I don't want her to, like, find love or whatever. Not that I don't want her to have that kind of, those kind of things. I just don't want it to become a relationship show. Or, you know, I would like, what's compelling to me is the track that she and Susie are on.
Totally.
And I would like that to be the thrust of where we go next.
Which is so funny, because I feel like, in a weird way, that might be a Paladino fatal flaw, to give her great women protagonists the least interesting love interest, where it's like,
just a bunch of drips.
Yeah. Kind of.
It's all our great Paladino women are surrounded by drips. You know, Luke, I'm sorry. Luke is a drip.
We can talk like this now. It's over.
And you know what? And it's, there's certain stuff about Luke that I love, but I there is no world in which I can imagine Lorelai and Luke.
Yeah.
You know, being happy forever. I just, it's not there for me.
It's a safe space.
I mean, I can imagine Lorelai and Jess
and you
together
do
more.
Frequently.
All the time. Every time I jerk off.
Yeah.
5 times a day.
MandzuKissJessFanfic.tumblr.com, where you can check it all out.
Yep. And just tweet that at Kevin T. Porter.
At Kevin T. Porter, your Archie serial killer podcast coming to an app near you. Jason, thanks for joining us for
this
conversation.
This was a delight.
This
as
was so
always.
Fun.
As
I
always.
Know. It was fun to do something a little different.
I am heartbroken that Alice wasn't here.
I was as well.
Please, Alice, if you're hearing this,
oh baby,
feel better.
Ooh.
And let's, I'm sorry I didn't make it on for one of the episodes, but I liked a full season rap. I'm sure I'm missing stuff that I'm forgetting that I would really like to talk about, but,
no,
but
well,
I really liked this show for me was a kind of like, it was like Amy Sherman Palladino's like Mary Tyler Moore show,
yeah,
you know, is somehow where it lives for me. And it was, I'm so excited.
For season two?
For season two.
Are you going out for it at all?
I wish. The minute they announced it, I was like, is there anything that I can audition for in this show? Yeah. And they were like, no. And so now that season, who knows what season two will be? But maybe there's like a weirdo guy that I can play. Maybe. Well, I mean, why not?
Here's what I would love is if you play Dennis, or not Dennis. Who's your character in A Year in the Life? What was his name? The lawyer.
Oh, the lawyer?
Yeah.
I don't remember his name.
That lawyer guy. Was a character.
Oh my God.
He's in like the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
You think he's like a time traveler?
Yeah, I think so.
He's like a Highlander?
He's going to be on the next season of Supernatural with Joel. He brings him there. He opens the portal.
Boy, I like
and
that.
Sends Joel through the portal.
I like that. I would love it if the last episode of Supernatural made a link with Dean from Gilmore Girls. Like, you realize it's the same guy.
Yeah, he says, wait, Rory's pregnant. Those are the final three words of that.
He goes, hey, what? Rory's pregnant? Pass me my hat.
He's not sure. Pass me my hat. Anything to plug?
No, not really.
No?
I mean, the How Did This Get Made podcast.
HDDGM.
And if you liked the chat that Kevin and I have had, there have been plenty of other chats we've had on the Gilmore Guys podcast that are much longer and more full of songs.
That's not a great plug for those episodes.
I would fast forward the songs. And I would, if it's Kevin and Demi singing, you can fast forward. And then if it's us talking, then you can listen.
Then there's
it's like
a musical. 15 minutes left.
It's almost like a musical.
It was a musical. People dogging the singing on and stuff. People dogging the solo bolos and those episodes.
Oh, I don't need those songs either.
Thanks so much, Jason.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We'll go out with Girls Talk. Come back for season two. We'll talk all about it.
Oh, happily. Oh, okay. here's the other thing. We're talking about things I'm looking for in season two.
Sure.
More boobs.
More boobs.
Just looking for more boobs in this show.
All right. That's a perfect note.
But by the way, that's a note for all shows.
All shows.
All shows.
Kevin Can Wait. More boobs.
More boobs. Dora the Explorer.
More boobs. Adventure Time, more boobs.
Oh, yeah.
That's the perfect note to go out.
Thank you,
Jason. And we'll see you next time on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, guys!
That was a HeadGum Podcast.